Good evening, everybody. In addition to all the things that you did said about me, I'm also the facilitator of the first and best session of this conference. So I hope you're looking forward to it as much as I am. I hope you can hear us in the back. Let me just say a couple of housekeeping items. Please make sure your phones are off. And secondly, any questions or discussion will be saved up until after the third speaker. We've set aside thinking space, so please keep your questions until then. Our first speaker is Chris Fortune, who's going to talk to us about RN in the diary.
Thank you. Good evening, and just before I start my presentation, I'm going to use a fair amount of visuals tonight, which is new for the story of RN, of the diaries RN. But before I start, I wanted just to make a few acknowledgments. First to Judith and Imago and the Freud Museum for putting on this and realizing this idea that has been floated a year or two ago, and wonderful to have that happen. So thanks to all of you. I want to make one note of somebody who came before in terms of the kind of work that Detective Christopher Fortune and Detective Billy Brennan do. It's Paul Rosen, who is really the father of psychoanalytic history in terms of not the father of the history, but the father of the detective work, so to speak. He was an amazing guy who was a friend of mine, a mentor, comrade, companion, and he really started the ball rolling by interviewing every person he could find who, back in the 1960s, who had known Freud, family members, people who had actually been patients. He had no recorder; he did it all by hand. But I just wanted to acknowledge he died about 7 years ago, and I just wanted to make a note for him. Two others, and they're both here tonight, which is an amazing coup for this conference. Fantastic. Judith Dupont, who's back there in the middle, and André Haynal, who are both huge figures in the Ferenczi rebirth and revival going back many years. And I just wanted to acknowledge their wonderful work and the way it has come to bear here at the Freud Museum. And so thanks to those two. And, oh, before I forget, just one second. The other connection to Judith Dupont was Le Coq Errant Translation Group. And Eva Brabant, who is also here, was a part of that group. And they did the first translation of the clinical diary, published in French, as Le Coq, as Le Journal, Clinique, and so I wanted to acknowledge their work too. 1993 was a huge year, exactly 20 years ago. We had three conferences that were in that year that celebrated Ferenczi's 130th birthday and the 60th year since his death. One was in Budapest early on called Ferenczi and the Psychoanalytic Vocation. One was here in London, put on by Judith Sekach and Jonathan Sklar, who is here. That was a huge landmark because it was the first time Ferenczi had been discussed in the British Psychoanalytic Institute. That was in 1993. He had been blacklisted, basically, and that was a huge thing. And I was honored to be a part of that meeting. Then there was one in Geneva with André Haynal had organized at the University of Geneva. It was more broadly conceived as a conference on 100 years of psychoanalysis, but there was a Ferenczi panel, which also was a part of the celebration of the Ferenczi year. So that was exactly 20 years ago. So we're here to talk about the diary this weekend. And one of the things that happened when the group in Paris with Judith Dupont and Le Coq Errant really spearheaded the translation and the publication in 1988, 5 in French, in 1988 in English by Harvard Press. I believe that's what generated an immense amount of energy around the help to revive the Ferency world, because this diary is an amazing document, which you would know. So here we are again in London, and that 1993, sorry, also was the year that the book was published called The Legacy of Sándor Ferency by Lewis Aaron and Adrian Harris in New York. And it was the first, I think, the first real coming together of papers and chapters on Ferency. Critical book. It still is a very important touchstone for the work on Ferency, and there's been a second introduction done. You can actually download this book online at the Sándor Ferency Center in New York at the New School for Social Research. So, to my talk tonight. I know I don't have a long time, but I'm going to use this imagery. It's working fine. Stefan here is a young man down below. You can't see him, but he's done a really great job. He's connected to the Ford Museum. Now, I've never done this before. I've never done a techno-type situation. So, okay, the diaries are in. And we have a real mix of audience here. Some people know this story of RN so well, and they've heard me many times speak about it. And I know others here probably are new to RN and Ferency himself. So I'm going to have to do a bit of a synopsis of the story, but hopefully it'll interest those of you who know the story by providing some imagery that will be new that you won't have seen before. So when this book was published, the one that you just saw, the Legacy book, one of the chapters was a chapter called The Case of RN, Sándor Ferency's Radical Experiment in Psychoanalysis. And that chapter presented material, biographical, and research that supported and added to the clinical material that was in the diary. The diary really brought forward this patient, RN, who was the code name, the RN was the code name for an American woman named Elizabeth Severn. I will probably go back and forth between referring to her as RN and Severn, or Elizabeth Severn. 2 decades later, as I say, 93, and here we are, her importance in the history of psychoanalysis has really been confirmed. She's really, some people have called her one of the most important patients in psychoanalytic history, in tandem with what Ferency did with her. Severn's life, particularly focusing on her childhood, during which she seemingly suffered extreme abuse, and these very early traumas were a confusion of tongues, which is the very important paper, but also the idea of Ferency's that I think Severn herself was very much a part of generating those ideas for Ferency that led to that paper. Her chronic symptoms drove her on a really desperate journey to alleviate some very difficult symptoms and psycho-emotional suffering that finally brought her to Budapest. And really her last hope was Sándor Ferency, who she had tried others. She had seen Otto Rank in New York. She had had other psychoanalysts or therapists. And to a person, most people would say, well, you better go to Ferency. He was the one who worked with the most difficult cases. And so she went, I'm getting ahead of myself, but she went in 1924. So I'm just going to give you a brief background on Elizabeth Severn. And this is Elizabeth Severn here. And she was born in the late 1870s. In a small town in the American Midwest. Little is really known of her parents. She was in all likelihood subjected to early abuse, as I said. And she was a sickly child. She was plagued with fears and anxieties, and throughout her childhood and teenage and early adult years, she experienced chronic fatigue, violent headaches, and eating disorders. She later reports having amnesia about her life before 12 years old. There's a picture of her a little older. Another one of her. Lovely portrait of her there. These were taken, I would guess, probably in her 20s and early 30s. She didn't actually come to Ferency until she was 44. Here is a picture of her. As I said, she was constantly in some form of almost like nervous breakdown. And in those early part of the century, there were many places to go for rest cures. And this would have been in the early 1900s, around 1900. She was bedridden for a while, but then she would recover. She got married in the early part of the century and had a daughter named Margaret. Margaret was born in 1901. And within a few years, though, the marriage broke down. And she traveled with her daughter. Obviously, Margaret is the young one there. There's Elizabeth with Margaret on the right. And this is Margaret, who you'll find out later was an important dancer. This is early part of the look of the Pavlova period or the Isadora Duncan period of dance. This was actually a drawing that Margaret did of her mother that was from a photograph. And we're now at a point where she's in the story where she had, just to put the one piece in the middle, she had developed a really strong relationship to a metaphysical kind of practice. And she actually practiced as what she called a psychotherapist. And so she had some relationship to working with psychological ideas, but also metaphysical ideas, and this becomes important in her experience. And in 1913, I'm just ahead of myself a bit, but let's just go back so we're not looking at that. In 1913, she published a book called Psychotherapy, Its Doctrine and Practice, which was based on her ideas of willpower, dreams, visualization, and telepathic healing. And although she lacked any formal academic credentials, she identified herself as a PhD, Dr. Severn, and that carried on throughout her life. So her symptoms continued through the whole period, even though she was obviously functioning. She was a mother. She helped her daughter with her career as a dancer. Margaret started dancing when she was 6 or 7 and was performing when she was in her young teen years. So her mother was very supportive of that. So we're going to just kind of collapse a little bit of that period. And because, again, this is a synopsis. If you really want to read more detail, you could go to the legacy book and the chapter. So she goes to find Ferency in 1924. And she goes and goes to Budapest, where she stays in various hotels as she's starting to see Ferency. One hotel here is on your left, the Duna Pilota, which is no longer there, but it's right on the Danube. And she stayed there for a year or two. She also stayed at another hotel, which is right on the Danube, if you know Budapest, which many of you do. It was called the Hotel Bristol. And this was a postcard that she sent to Margaret. Margaret and her mother corresponded almost daily. There was that many letters over many years because Margaret was on tour dancing. And by this point, when Elizabeth is in Budapest, she is, as I said, 44. Margaret was 23 when she first goes to Budapest. So she sends this, this is what she wrote. "This is the way the Danube has looked from my window for weeks. The ice parted at just this time, something for some unknown reason. Otherwise it is quite solid. The duct, all day on the edge and do it perfectly. I never knew the meaning of the word until I watched them. See the Gellert Hill at the left, 1929. So if we jumped ahead, some of the dates are going to be back and forth, if you don't mind, you know. She wrote letters and the envelopes, this was, the back of the envelope. This was not the stamp, but it says, "See the Pearl of the Danube, Budapest, Hungary, Hotel Dunapalota, the Ritz, Grand Hotel, Hungaria." Now, Margaret, the daughter, is on tour. This is her in her early 20s. She created some dance pieces that were based on masks, and she became known as a dancer using masks, and she would put a mask on. She had maybe 6 or 7 or 10 masks, and she would come out from behind with a mask on and do a dance that related to the mask that she was wearing. In fact, this is the Orpheum Theater in Vancouver, where I'm from. In 1927 or 6, she was in Vancouver. This will come back to how I got to be a part of this story. 1925, Ferenczi was very impressed with Severin when they first met. Tom, I just better keep track of time because I have way too much and I'm gonna, okay. Just give me some signs. 1925, she's been there roughly a year. And as I said, Ferenczi was impressed, but he was a little anxious about her. He wrote about her that she had majestic superiority of a queen. And he responded to this majestic superiority of a queen with intrepid masculinity. By 1926, though, I'm just going to tell you about this. This was a well-known photograph of Shandor, which says he dedicated to her, "To Dr. Elizabeth Severin as a token of high consideration, Budapest, December 1925. This dedication is from one of her early, she wrote two books, one of her early books she gave to Ferenczi, saying, "With appreciation to one who can still find fragrance in the garlands of former years." Very poetic. Sandor Ferenczi, from his grateful pupil, Elizabeth Severin, Budapest, July 9th, 1925. Oh, wait a minute. There we are. So we're going to go to, after 1926, sorry, I'm going to go back. 1926, 1927, the analysis was carrying on, and it started well, but then it bogged down. And by 1926, it was actually stalling, and Ferenczi was trying his techniques of different approaches that he was trying to do. And he was determined that he was going to help Elizabeth Severin. So a number of years go by with them struggling to work with what issues are coming up for her. But in 1928, a breakthrough came, and utilizing relaxation and regression techniques, including trance states and an emphasis on dream analysis, Severin and Ferenczi lifted the veil of early amnesia. If you remember, she didn't remember seemingly anything before she was 12 years old. They reconstructed events of a severe case of sexual, physical, and emotional abuse by her father beginning at age 1.5. The recovered memories of unconscious material was horrendous, bizarre, including memories not only of incest, but of murder and of being drugged and prostituted to other men. Ferenczi writes that the traumatic shocks throughout her childhood left Severn in a state of almost total psychic disintegration with severe amnesia. As he quoted, it was a confusion of chaotically jumbled memory impressions from her past. The reason I have this here is in 1928, Ferenczi was so concerned about the state of her condition as she was going through this retrieval, recovery, regression, that he went on a trip to Spain, to Madrid, to a number of places, and he brought, this is now Elizabeth Severn here, Ferenczi in the middle, and this is Gisela Ferenczi on your left. This picture has been in the literature for quite some time, and originally the caption was, "This is Sandor Ferenczi, Gisela, and an unknown woman." Now we now know who that woman is. We've known for a while that it was Elizabeth Severn, and the picture was actually taken in a mirror. Her daughter told me the picture was, they took the picture in a mirror, so they're looking in the mirror and taking a picture somehow. But this is, anyway, I could talk about this. So, sorry, I'm going to just have to keep focused because I'm not going to get through this. In 1929, again, Ferenczi was so concerned about her condition that he wrote to Grodek, and every year he would go to see Grodek, go to the sanatorium of George Grodek, his very good friend, that he really became friends with starting in 1921. And there he and Gisela would have, you know, spend time with the Grodeks. But he, that year in 1929, he didn't go. He said, "George, I can't go. It's too important what's happening with my patient. You know who it is." I can't remember exactly what he says in the letter. And I have this image. This is actually, I edited the correspondence between Ferenczi and Grodek that was published in English after it was published in German and French, and we had some new letters. So I have that image to kind of denote this relationship with Grodek, which was very, very important. But it was so critical that he didn't go to show how he was taking so seriously this case of RN. In 1930, Ferenczi writes optimistically that Severn's case is exhausting but worthwhile, and he hopes to announce what it means to complete an analysis. This becomes really important. I think it's a discussion point that should carry on a bit further about what Ferenczi's ideas were developing about an analysis and what would be a complete analysis. Here's a letter addressed by Margaret, the daughter, to her mother at the Hotel Hungaria. Margaret went through all the letters of her mother, and on the envelopes she would write something that was significant about what might be contained in the letter. Sequel to letter of December 6, recovery. This relates to her mother, kind of getting through things. And here's another letter that is 1932, but I'm going to catch up to that now because for 2 years, as he continued to work very hard with her. Then his attentive behavior, because he even gave her much more time than one would normally expect to a patient. But the reaction was that Elizabeth Severn found his attentions. She thought she had found her what she called perfect lover, or what he quoted as. And Ferenczi became alarmed. He backed off, reduced his super performances, as he sometimes called them. And Severn then reacted to this withdrawal by challenging him that she suspected he harbored hidden negative feelings, hate and anger towards her, which blocked her analysis. She demanded to analyze those feelings in him, or she said her analysis would remain at an impasse. Ferenczi resisted this demand, really, that she made that she analyze him for a year, and then he reluctantly agreed to submit to her analysis. So began the experiment in mutual analysis. Okay, I'm going to... So the analysis carried on. In 1932, Ferenczi starts his diary, which he writes for, I think, 8 or 9 months. This is a... They carry on the mutual analysis. It's well documented and amplified in the diary. And you must read this book if you're at all interested. It's a phenomenal piece of work. During this period, now we're in August. I think the diary started in early in the spring, if not January, I think even. And this is now August. And this is Margaret's notes on front of the envelope. Disappointment in fair. She does the abbreviation. Disappointment in fair and analysis. And then she talks about her own. This is heat, vaudeville, appearance. So she collapses two pieces. One responding to her mother and the other here. The reason I'm even noting the notes on the envelope is that the letters of Elizabeth Severn do not exist anymore. The daughter burned them. The mother, Elizabeth, had asked her not to keep them, and she did keep them. But this is another story of my relationship to this story and meeting. I met Margaret, the daughter, in Vancouver. But just a little piece of Margaret's comment back to her mother in 1932. Darling, your last letter is the most hopeful one yet, and certainly... Again, this is the August letter. Certainly seems to bear out the feeling that you had on the train when we came here together. Well, even considering the fact that fares complexes have lengthened your analysis or made recovery impossible. Again, mother and daughter. Daughter is very always supportive of mom. So what we're getting here is Margaret's filter of what her hearing from her mother. So Ferenczi's complexes have lengthened your illness or made recovery impossible up to the present date. Still, capital letters. Without him, you wouldn't have got well either. So maybe that was the only way to do it. Painful though it has been and is being, because angry as you may well be now, which we know from the diary, there was some real struggles back and forth between Ferenczi and Severn. When you see what part his unconscious has played, we agreed that you would not have, I know what it says. Basically, you wouldn't have survived without him. Can you read that? Continued to live. So the poor man has something to his credit, even if the present revelations are a terrible blow. But I see you say somewhat the same as I did about the dangers of analysis. They are terrific. But so are the dangers of medicine, and many a victim has perished from that. So maybe eventually analysis will emerge. Anyway, she goes on. She has her opinions. This is a picture of Elizabeth, the mom, 1932. Was for sure taken in 32 because on the back of the photograph that I saw has been written in her own hand that year. And just see where we are here. Okay, I'm just going to tell you quickly. 32, Ferenczi starts to get ill. He's going to survive until 1933, wherein he dies of pernicious anemia, but he was starting to become ill. And he was reducing his practice. It was very upsetting, obviously, for all his patients. Elizabeth Severn left in 1933 in February. The two of them, according to Severn and Billy's, having read the interview that Elizabeth Severn did with Kurt Eisler in 1959, that supposedly they were working on a book together, Ferenczi and Severn. She claims that. And the book she wrote while she was in Budapest in the main and then published a year later in London, 1933, was called The Discovery of the Self, A Study in Psychological Cure, Elizabeth Severn. This book, if you read, it's written in a very sort of out-of-date sort of style, but within it, there are really important aspects. Very different than the diary in terms of, this is a diary. But the two pieces are what we have out of these two people's relationship and what they came out of it. At the end, Elizabeth survives again until 1959. Ferenczi dies in 1933. And in this book, she tries to pull together the two pieces, the two major pieces of her life, the metaphysical early period and the psychoanalytic, and she tries to do that in the book. So there's a kind of aspect to that. Let's see what else is there. These are two journals these are 1936, 35. She was living in London. She published papers in the London Forum, incorporating the Occult Review, the Practical Psychology magazine. She was not a psychoanalytically on that track purely, but here's the title of two papers that she did. One here, Don't Be Ashamed of Your Instincts, and here, Psychoanalysis and Spiritual Evolution. Oh, that, I can't go on to this. That's the other part of the story. I'm just going to tell you what I'm not going to say. I have something I wanted to say about the whole thing of meeting the daughter, how we first found out about Severn, which in fact was by name in Jeffrey Mason's book, The Assault on Truth. And I'm going to write a book. I want finally pulling all of my pieces of this, my own story of researching and detective work, and also the pieces to contribute a whole kind of piece to the story of RN and what we have with the diary. And I have one picture I have to end on. That's me and her, 1986. She looks older and I look younger. There, yeah. The painting is in the Freud Museum. It's what Don has just mentioned. I'm totally delighted, looking forward to that. Here's Sandor. This is a picture that was taken of her, a portrait, probably about 1936. She looks very good. She looks better. She looks much, much better than she did in 1932. So when people say, when I asked her, do you think, Margaret, what do you think about Ferenczi's work with Severn? She said she would not have survived without him. So I think it's a testament to him. And I think she has played quite a role.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Kit Severn. We come to the next presentation, which will be Billy Brennan.
Thank you.
Once they have passed the baton. And Billy is going to talk about biographical notes on identities concealed and revealed in the diary.
Okay, can everybody hear me okay? Great. Just a few words of thanks at the beginning. And that is to Judith, Tom, and Ivan for all of the hard work that they've done in putting this conference together. And also to Andre Hainal and Judith DuPont for their encouragement and support of a very early draft of this paper, which I had sent to them. So I'm going to begin with a couple of quotations. The first is one that Freud was supposed to be very fond of. It's from W.H. Auden. And Auden said, "Private faces in public places are wiser and nicer than public faces in private places." I'll leave it to your Freudian imagination around what he meant by public faces in private places. And then on to a quote from the introductory lectures from Freud. Quote, "And if you were a detective engaged in tracing a murder, would you expect to find that the murderer had left his photograph behind at the place of the crime, with his address attached? Or would you not necessarily have to be satisfied with comparatively slight and obscure traces of the person you were in search of? So do not let us underestimate small indications. By their help, we may succeed in getting on the track of something bigger." End of quote. And then a quote from Michael Ondaatje from Anil's Ghost. "Why did you get into such a business? I love history. The intimacy of entering all those landscapes, like entering a dream. Someone nudges a stone away, and there's a story." So I'm going to start with the backstory. A number of summers ago, I was sitting in a movie theater watching the movie Zodiac, where the protagonist becomes obsessed with cracking a code of a serial killer. I find myself wishing for something so consuming. The next section is called Small Indications and Obscure Traces. There we go. Great. In 2007, I began researching Azette de Forest, a lay analyst who had studied and trained with Sándor Ferenczi in the late 1920s. What started as a seemingly pedestrian exploration of a peripheral lay analyst soon led me deeper and deeper in the unexplored terrain of Ferenczi and his American patients. Researching de Forest's life story led me to a collection of letters detailing her analysis with Ferenczi, started during his active technique phase. De Forest may not have been a great psychoanalytic luminary, but nonetheless, she was part of the constellation of Ferenczi's pupils, and her book, The Leaven of Love, published in the 1950s, was a testament to Ferenczi's technique. The story which emerged was that, although at the margins, De Forest had been pivotal in the transmission of Ferenczi's ideas, and was in many regards his forgotten messenger. Reading the clinical diary, I was struck by a few details about the patient ETT, and this is from the diary entry on the 17th of May, 1932. With the biographical information I had researched on De Forest, accompanied by the reconstruction of what had occurred in her analysis with Ferenczi, it led me to identify De Forest as patient ETT. The details offered by Ferenczi mapping onto details I knew of De Forest's history, that she'd been in analysis in Budapest that had lasted over a year. At the time, she was dissatisfied with her marriage to her husband, Alfred, who had polio. Alfred was a cousin of Dorothy Burlingham. Azette continued to see Ferenczi for supervised control analysis when he came to the New School in New York in 1926. That she had had an affair in 1927 with a pediatrician at Metropolitan Memorial Hospital, and that she had developed a strong intellectual transference to Sándor Rado, whose seminar she participated in when he came to New York. Although De Forest's case is only a fleeting vignette in the clinical diary, I was surprised at how easily identifiable she was based on the few facts disclosed. Oh, you can? Okay, I'll speak up then. Ferenczi's clinical diary is an important historical document for psychoanalysis. It takes us into the mind, heart, and soul of one of psychoanalysis's most creative minds. As Judy Vida has said, his clinical diary is the original lab book. It captures the analyses of 8 of Ferenczi's cases as they were unfolding on a daily basis. Oh, thanks. Those familiar with the diary know that the patients were RN, DM, SI, B, U, OS, NHD, and G. As Michael Ballant noted in his preface, it is entirely spontaneous as a real diary ought to be. Ferenczi himself saw it as a scientific poetry and truth. It resists the neat packaging of case histories as they are presented in journal articles, where patients are fitted into the Procrustean bed of theory, neatly tucked in between the sheets of metapsychology. Instead, it struggles, raw, vulnerable. It embraces the difficult, is unflinchingly honest, and offers us clinical process as it unfolds. When the clinical diary was published in 1988, it did not directly reveal the identity of any of the patients. In the editor's note, Judith DuPont wrote that Clara Thompson and Elizabeth Severn are cited in the diary, but that their initials were altered according to Ferenczi's own style, and would only be apparent to the informed reader. We're also told that between DM, RN, SI, and B, that three of these women are American. However, at the beginning of the diary, a footnote reveals Thompson's identity as DM, the context being her kiss-and-tell bragging of Ferenczi's relaxation technique and Freud's reprimanding letter to Ferenczi. Ferenczi had mentioned his work with Elizabeth Severn as a collaborator in two of his theoretical papers, so it was common knowledge in the analytic community that she was in training with him. And as Kit has already sort of given you the sort of story of RN, I'm going to sort of skip over that. But there's a picture of her from 1925, the picture that's in the museum at the moment from 1914. So returning to DeForest, one last thing that Ferenczi notes about her tripartite division of her libido is that she had fallen in love with a very attractive girl. A close reading of the diary, as well as collateral evidence in the DeForest archive, led me to identify patient B as Alice Lowell. I had interviewed Alice's last lover, who wears a gold Cartier band that Azette had given to Alice. Alice came from one of the branches of the Boston Brahmin Lowell family. Her brother, Dr. Francis Cabot Lowell, was roommates with Lincoln Kirstein, one of her early crushes, and her sister, Marianne Lowell, married the philosopher Jacques Burzon. She was born on April 16, 1906, making her almost 20 years younger than Azette. Alice was musically gifted. She studied under Nadia Boulanger in Paris, was a skilled cellist and singer. She performed with Winthrop Eames's Gilbert and Sullivan Productions in New York. And although initially intending to become an analyst, she began studying medicine and then specialized in internal medicine and eventually became the medical director and chief of medicine at the New England Hospital in Boston. She was known as a woman of great style and commanding presence. Having discovered DeForest and Lowell's identities in the clinical diary made me curious about the identities of the other patients in the diary. The little accent is the wrong way around. I just noticed that earlier. I'm a little obsessional. So having discovered DeForest and Lowell's identity made me curious about the other patients in the diary. Why is knowing these patients important? Historical research and biographical data on Freud's famous cases have provided us with valuable information, as well as providing us with the social and cultural context for understanding these patients. If my hypothesis is correct, and this is a part of the painting or part of the illustration that you may be familiar with that Ernst Falsater did on who analyzed who in the early years, and this is just a section around Sándor Ferenczi. And this was another of my inspirations. So if my hypothesis is correct, then the research which I've done shows that none of the patients in the diary were Hungarian. Most were from extremely wealthy socioeconomic backgrounds, and they were all either born in America or had lived in America. And there's also, as you will see, a lot of gender bending going on. The interconnectedness of these patients' relationships to each other is also important, and this is something that Emmanuel Berman is going to touch on in the next presentation. There are important ways in which their lives overlapped with each other. It's no surprise that the phrase 6 degrees of separation originated from a Hungarian writer. and the interconnectedness of the patients within the diary further complicates the clinical picture. All of Ferenczi's patients were in some ways involved with one another, with the exception of patient G, who in the past had been involved with Freud. In the latter part of the paper, if I have time, I will address the ethics of revealing these identities, as well as consider some of the complexities of writing history and biography within the domain of psychoanalysis. So moving on. So I've mapped out here the various patients in the diary that we know, as well as the other ones who I hope to reveal. So a word about process. Any detective starts with leads. Perhaps my addiction to Law and Order, Poirot, and Miss Marple has paid off. Although Ferenczi's correspondence with Freud and Grotek mentions some patients' names, none of these patients are explicitly mentioned there. And I think this is interesting because there's a way that the patients that Ferenczi was working with, he really didn't write to other people about. And that in some ways it was access to DeForest's letters, and she was writing to Clara Thompson as well as to Alice Lowell, that various people were mentioned. And so what I would do is anytime anybody was mentioned, I would note the name down and then would start to research the person, just out of curiosity to find out who they were. A lot of times it would be consulting newspapers, U.S. passports, and before 1925, often people would include in the passport, if they were going to Europe, a letter of intention. So you would actually, they might note down that they were actually going to study with Otto Rank, or that they were going to Budapest to study with Ferenczi. I also consulted the ship liner notes, to sort of see who was traveling when and who was traveling with who, the Social Security Death Index, and other archival material. Eventually I developed a working hypothesis of how the patient's identities were encoded and disguised using particular pseudonyms. And part of the difficulty was that there was no one consistent code. So in the diary, there is a logic in terms of why certain initials are used, but it's not the same for each person. When the clinical diary was published, Michael Ballant made sure that the initials were consistent within the clinical diary. And I had an opportunity, after I'd written this paper, to actually look at the original clinical diary and was able to then sort of see how, at various points in the original, different initials or different pseudonyms were used that were then streamlined to what we have today. So let's start with OS, who is Natalie Rogers. Rather than give you, the other thing I would do is I would go through the diary and map out specific facts that were told about the person. Like if their mother had died, if they had a brother who was shot, if they were the youngest of three. So I would start to map out facts, and then as I got to know different people, often what I would know about them would map onto the facts that were given. So I'm not going to go through the facts that are given in the diary. You can sort of go back and look at those yourself. I'm just going to sort of dive in and give you background on the person. Can you hear me at the back? Great. So Miss Natalie Rogers, as she liked to be called, which does simplify things considering that she was married three times, and hints at her progressive feminist leanings, was surely Ferenczi's most colorful patient. What she lacked in affect, she made up for in personality. She arrived in Ferenczi's consulting room as if she'd stepped straight out of one of Jay Gatsby's parties. I imagine her a mix of 30s flapper, wealthy socialite meets Indiana Jones. She came from wealth, part of the Warburg, Schiff, Kuhn, and Loeb banking fortune. Her mother, Clara Heimsheimer, divorced her father, Charles McIlvain Rogers, and later remarried. When Natalie was 9 years old, her mother married her stepfather, Dr. Henry Fraunthal, in Nice, and for their honeymoon boarded a luxurious liner in Cherbourg on April 10, 1912. 4 days later, her parents were among the 33 survivors to be rescued in Lifeboat 5. Having one's parents survive the Titanic might have made one cautious about the possible dangers in the world. Instead, Natalie emerged as a fierce and fearless adventurer. As a 22-year-old who had been studying medicine at Cornell, she was the first white woman to explore areas of the Brazilian Amazon beyond the River of Doubt. While other 20-somethings toured Europe, Natalie chose a different path and was deep in the jungle. She was accompanied by her newly acquired first husband, Oscar de Lima Mayer, a mining engineer and graduate of Harvard, and her classmate and close friend, Ora Ford, also a junior at Cornell. Natalie was intrigued by stories of a strange country in the interior of Bolivia from which few travelers had returned. And despite warnings from the United States consul, the avid adventurers ventured on. Part of the trip that was supposed to take 12 days ended up taking 3 weeks. At one point, all three had malarial fever. Balsa rafts were constructed from the trunks of trees, a cut above your usual Girl Scout skills. Crocodile-infested rivers were successfully negotiated. They hiked in 130-degree temperatures. When supplies ran out, the ever-resourceful Natalie, in a pre-Julia Child era, made omelets from turtle eggs and broiled monkey meat. At night, they slept with a revolver close at hand, as danger was ever present. The natives didn't quite know what to make of Miss Natalie Rogers and experienced their first bout of gender trouble. Natalie wore overalls, or sometimes her pajamas. It was, after all, the Amazon, and not Fifth Avenue. Her bobbed hair and lack of infant in tow made them convinced that she was a man. However, Natalie's coup in the Amazon was ultimately her haircut, bringing the symbol of the liberated woman to South America. "My bobbed hair," Natalie told the New York Times, "created a sensation in all the settlements we visited along the Mapiri and Beni rivers. In one place, all the women visited me to have their hair bobbed, and I was kept busy with my scissors." Natalie brought back several monkeys, macaws, parakeets, parrots, and crocodile skins, which explains the menagerie she brought with her to Budapest. In the diary, it actually mentions that she had monkeys with her, and so now we know how she was able to sort of arrive there. The Chicago Daily Tribune shows a picture of Rogers with a brace of monkeys and wearing a dress made out of the bark of a tree. So you can see sort of what a colorful character she was. In November 1926, accompanied by Ora Ford, but without her husband, the two set out for another adventure to investigate the Seri Indians and were the first white women to visit the island of Tiburon off the coast of Mexico. The Seri, not to be confused with the voice on your iPhone, had been known to have been cannibalistic and had reportedly never seen white women before. The chief honored Natalie by giving her a robe made of 12 pelican skins. He admired Natalie's leather jacket lined with alpaca, which she had brought back from Bolivia, and told her he did not have a coat. Natalie had been warned that the Seri were infamous thieves and would often be admiring and then murder the owner if need be, to possess the coveted item. But the unflappable flapper told reporters, "I spent a very uncomfortable few moments wondering what I was up against, but if the chief had any designs for robbery and murder, he abandoned them." In March 11, 1927, Natalie's stepfather, Dr. Henry Fronthal, a noted orthopedic surgeon, committed suicide from the 7-story window of his apartment in Manhattan. And what had begun as a 2-room clinic, Fronthal had transformed into the prestigious Hospital for Joint Diseases. 2 years later, Natalie's uncle died, leaving her a net estate worth $9 million. Natalie's mother died in Blythewood Sanitarium in 1943, leaving Natalie the sole beneficiary. The passenger records show Natalie arriving in Europe in 1928, accompanied by Kira Nijinsky, who was under her care, and Kira later went into analysis with Anna Freud and enrolled in the Heidsieck School, along with Dorothy Burlingham's children. Natalie would hit the headlines again in 1942, 10 years after her analysis with Ferenczi, this time with husband number 2, Joseph Sepp Froelich, an international Olympic skier who had been arrested for questioning by the FBI because of his ties to Germany. Froelich was an instructor in Sun Valley and met Miss Rogers in St. Moritz. He was arrested with two other internationally famous skiers. What is notable in the news reports is that they focus less on any suspected espionage and more on Miss Rogers' personal attempt at penal reform. She insisted that the furniture at the facility, at the jail, was seriously inadequate for her husband, and in an extreme makeover, sent a truckload of her choice of furniture to the jail. Attendants refused to accept the furniture, and it stayed on the sidewalk for a whole day before being returned to the store. Later, she protested about the quality of food being served in the jail and offered to send meals to her husband from the outside. This offer was declined, but in the end, Natalie won out, and later food for all inmates at the jail arrived and was served for a 3-day period. You can tell that this was a woman to be reckoned with. Her second marriage also ended in divorce, but Natalie remarried again, another European ski instructor, the Austrian Alois Morischer, who lived in Santa Barbara on a ranch. And I actually had a chance to talk to his daughter. So moving on then to Natalie's friend, who in the diary is known as N.D., or the initials N.H.D. And one thing I would say, Natalie's initials of O.S. were obscured by the next initial in the alphabet. So N.R. became O.S. That's how they were described. So Natalie's friend, tracking down Natalie Rogers' female companion proved more difficult. At the beginning, I wondered if her traveling companion in Bolivia or a Ford was N.D., but this was not the case. Another lead was the fact that Natalie was caring for Kira Nijinsky. In researching Nijinsky, I came across several references in Peter Heller's work on the Heidsieck School, which Anna Freud and Dorothy Boerlingham had founded. Heller notes that a young girl in the school, Anne Niederhood's mother, was the lover of Kira Nijinsky's mother. So operating on the assumption that Heller was referring to Kira's new adoptive mother, then maybe N.D. And N.H.D. in the diary referred to Niederhood. And although Natalie Rogers' initials were changed to O.S. in the diary, could her friend's initials be unaltered? The girl with this strange-sounding Dutch name is also mentioned in Burlingham's biography of Dorothy, but with a different spelling. So I set out to track down this mysterious Dutch family, which it turns out both authors spelled incorrectly. Eventually, I came across an obscure childhood biography entitled Wither from Aulis by Ank Wheels, previously known as Anne Niederhood. Her biography confirms that her mother went to Europe with Natalie Rogers, and together they saw Ferenczi. Although Anne proves to be a clumsy historian, she reports that Natalie lost her parents on the Lusitania. They had actually survived the Titanic. That Ferenczi died of a brain tumor, and it was actually pernicious anemia, and that Natalie committed suicide, which she didn't. None of which happened, but given her estrangement from her mother, it's not surprising that she filled in the gaps with these partial truths. She describes Natalie as a beautiful, slightly plump, childlike person. Anne does provide a picture of her mother, albeit a fuzzy one. The autobiography is marked more by her mother's absence than her presence. Depositing her daughter with an elderly spinster couple who ran an orphanage in Philadelphia and later in a boarding school, her mother focused on her career. There is something in her daughter's narrative voice which captures the traces of melancholy and sadness, loneliness and neglect. And this is a quote from Anne's autobiography. She says, "Very early on, I developed a preference for dimness, shade, coolness, and the minor moments at the edge of the day. For the unseen, the long slant shadows cast by the sinking sun, for mists and steel gray folds of clouds under low over hills, for the andante of rain dripping from the eaves." The other interesting thing is that in Anne's autobiography, she never mentions the Dutch name Niederhood at all. Her mother, Roberta Morfitt Niederhood, who always referred to herself as Robbie, was born in Melbourne, Australia, to English parents. Anne writes, "My mother was entirely self-educated, musically highly sensitive, widely read, witty and fastidious in her tastes. But owing to family circumstances, there being two older sisters who were sent back to England to school, she was both unschooled as well as untrained. She was tiny, dark, intense, and imperious in manner." According to Anne, her parents met and married after only 3 weeks of acquaintance, her mother's motivation to escape Australia, which they did when Anne was 18 months old. Her father, William Niederhode, was Dutch. They spent some time in Japan before coming to the States in 1916. Shortly after coming to the States, the marriage fell apart, and Anne would never see her father again. Robbie worked her way up in the advertising department of Cunard Ship Lines, then in an executive fur shop in New York, and finally was an editor for Time and Country. She also wrote for Women's Home Journal, as well as Harper's Bazaar, including a piece in 1913 on eating in Budapest. When Anne was 16, she accompanied her mother and Natalie to Europe, but then became ill with bronchial pneumonia. Eventually, Anne travels to Vienna to stay with Eva Rosenfeld, known as Mushi, Anna's Freud's close friend, and who was also involved in a Heitzig school. Margaret Severn, who Kate has mentioned, Elizabeth Severn's daughter, often mentioned Natalie and Robbie as the Nat Meter outfit. She writes, "I always found them amusing and at least alive, which is more than can be said for most people." Elizabeth Severn even considered in the last year of writing a book with Niederhode, which she didn't do. As for Robbie, after Ferenczi's death, Anne reports that she succumbed to alcoholism after breaking up with Natalie and was checked into a sanatorium outside Vienna in February 1934. The story doesn't have a happy ending. Her mother returned to England, and Anne would visit her once a year in Hertfordshire. Robbie died, according to her daughter, friendless and penniless. And the day she died, her daughter was the only solitary presence in the funeral procession. So that's, so moving on now to patient S.I., who is Harriet Shigray. It's my hypothesis that S.I. In the diary stands for Shigray, and that in the notes and fragments that was published in the International Journal, there's a patient that's mentioned as just the letter H, designating Hattie, which is how she liked to be known. The DeForest Archive describes Harriet as being a patient of Ferenczi in 1925, which fits with Ferenczi's description of the analysis being interrupted by his trip to the States. The other details given about patient S.I. align themselves with known facts about Shigray's life. She had only one child, had three sisters, the oldest, which was said to be the prettiest, and a brother who unexpectedly died of a heart attack in November 1930. Hattie was born on July 12, 1884, in Butte, Montana, the youngest daughter of Marcus Daly, the Copper King. Marcus Daly arrived in America as a 15-year-old Irish immigrant, dirt poor, and eventually made his way to California and became involved in the mining industry. He later bought a mine in Montana. There wasn't gold in their hills, or even silver, as he had suspected. Instead, there was copper, which soon jettisoned Daly to be one of the wealthiest men in America. Harriet was his youngest daughter. His eldest, Margaret, married Carol Brown and died of a heart attack in 1911. And her other sister was married to James Watson Girard, who was appointed by President Wilson in 1912 to be the American ambassador to the court of Emperor William of Germany. Harriet was described as a strikingly beautiful girl of the brunette type and is famous for her rose leaf complexion. Soon this country girl from Bitterroot Valley, Montana, was debuting in New York, her fortune estimated at $7 million. The townhouse that she kept on Fifth Avenue was adjacent to the Whitney and Huntington mansions. She met her husband at the wedding of Gladys Vanderbilt in 1908. They were married, and this is Count Anton Shigray. Harriet and Count Anton Shigray were married on the 29th of March, 1910. He was 30, she was 24. Their only child was born 10 months later. Count Chigre was a member of the Hungarian House of Lords, a polo player, and someone who had a penchant for duels. He was handsome and aristocratic, as one imagines a Hungarian polo-playing count to be. Although he belonged to one of the wealthiest families in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, it was nothing compared with Daly's dowry. In fact, many Americans were cynical of how many U.S. dollars were going overseas via the marriage. Here we have it sort of being reported that the marriage and more American dollars going across to Europe. In the interview that Elizabeth Severn gave to Kurt Eisler, she mentions a countess, although in her narrative she remains nameless. However, the DeForest archive reveals that Elizabeth Severn was friendly with Count Chigre and her sister, Mrs. Girard. And one of the things that I go on, I'll just cut this part a little short, is that Elizabeth Severn had run out of money, and at one point in the diary there is money that comes to sort of help her and her analysis. And it ends up coming from Harriet Chigre. Now, Harriet had been a patient of Elizabeth Severn's, and Elizabeth had referred Harriet to Ferency. And Elizabeth felt humiliated by this act, but in some ways Harriet was, I think in some ways, wanting to look after Ferency and wanting the analysis with Severn to come to an end. She often would warn Ferency that he wasn't taking enough care of himself, and also warned him not to let patients take more than he had to give. The Chigres ended up being able to escape the Nazis, but not without having been to a concentration camp, and then lived in New York. Harriet died in May 31st, 1950, and had been in failing health since her husband had died in 1947. And from reading the diary, you can tell that Harriet was one of Ferency's favorite patients, and even in the experiments he did with her in mutual analysis, was very enamored by her. So Patient U, I believe, is Teddy Miller, where the U is changed from T, which is the first letter of his name. And I don't have a picture of him, unfortunately. From the clinical diary, it's clear that patient U was very close to Clara Thompson. And in a letter to her friend, Clara Thompson describes how she leaned on Teddy when Ferency died, and that since they returned to the States, there had been distance between them. DeForest also mentions having dinner with Mr. Miller from New York, along with Rickman and Thompson. Passenger records reveal that Theodore Miller, a real estate merchant, traveled to Europe in 1929 with Chandor Lorand. He was born in 1902 and came to the States in 1914. He had actually been born in Brest-Litovsk in Poland. In 1931, he was living in Budapest, and he gave Dr. Clara Thompson as his next of kin. And when Ferency died, the two of them returned on the same ship to New York. I have to track down what happened to Miller when he returned to the States. He was still alive when Frome was writing his eyewitness testimony of Ferency's mental states in his last days, but Clara Thompson told Frome that he was unlikely to get any information from Miller. One of the other things that Clara Thompson revealed in her interview to Eisler was that she felt that, and this may have actually been her own projection, was that Ferency didn't really like Teddy Miller, and found him as somebody who was coarse and not as well cultured or educated as the likes of Alice Lowell. But it's also clear from the diary that Teddy and Clara had some sort of liaison or relationship. And Clara was also somebody who was very prone to feelings of shame. So it's unclear how much of her own sort of shame she was projecting onto Teddy. Then moving along to case G, which I believe is Angelica Frink. Now, case G had long remained a mystery to me. And I had gone back and forth in terms of thinking who it could be, until I had seen the original diary where, rather than G, the initials were FRK. And so I was thinking, is it Frink? Is it Frank? There's also a dream that's mentioned in the diary where the name Horace is mentioned, so I was thinking of Horace Callan or Horace Frink. And then in the Elizabeth Sever interview that she gave to Kurt Eisler, she actually mentions that Angelica Frink was a patient at the same time she was. I won't go into the whole sort of story of Horace Frink and Freud. You can sort of read that on your own. There's quite a bit has been written about it. But basically the story is that Horace Frink was an American. He came across in 1922 to be analyzed by Freud. Freud saw him as somebody who was potentially going to be a great leader in American psychoanalysis, but that he was already married, but was in love with one of his patients, Angelica. Angelica had first started working with Frink in 1917. And so during the course of the analysis, Horace decides that he will, in fact, get a divorce and that he will marry Angelica, except he's very sick and almost psychotic before the wedding. They do get married in December of 1922, but later on, Angelica feels very bitter that in some ways Freud had withheld from her the true condition that Frink was in, and that he was much sicker than she had thought. Here's a picture from the Freud Museum in their photo collection of Angelica, Freud, and Horace Frink. And you'll actually notice Freud holding her hand there. And so you can sort of see that there was a certain intimacy that's occurring in the photograph itself. And then another one, and here again you see the two of them they're sort of either arm in arm or hand in hand. Angelica and Horace did end up getting a divorce, but it wasn't without a suicide attempt on Horace Frink's end. And after that, Angelica really wouldn't talk about the story, although she went on to have a half-sister who was an analyst and who she did talk to. And she had actually, Viola had managed to convince her to keep the letters and correspondence that she had with Freud, and she had agreed to do it. Although the day that she died, apparently they were burned. But there were some artifacts that did remain, including some telegrams and some photocopies of letters that Frink had sent to her. How close am I? Okay. So there's a picture of the two of them. They went on honeymoon in Egypt. King Tut's tomb had just been opened. So there we have a more complete picture of who the various people were in the diary. I don't have time to go through the second part of the paper, but basically in it I sort of discuss the ethics of revealing patients' identities. And this is something that within the field is sort of very controversial. You have a lot of psychoanalysts on one hand who prefer not to reveal any identities, and so when it comes to even published correspondence, prefer not to even put in the initials. Whereas you have other people who sort of believe that a long enough time has passed and that knowing who these people really were is important. And so I talk about that, but I will end with a quote. And I think the other point that I'd like to make is that with digitization, any identifying facts about a patient, like back then people were writing, they didn't know that all of their material was going to be digitized. And, you know, 10, 15 years ago, historians might have to go through microfiche looking for things. When things have now been digitized, you just have to type in a word and you can find it. And so there's a way that I think, with our technological advances, it creates a whole different terrain. And in some ways, I think this is a cautionary tale in terms of all it really takes is one or two facts, and we are able to figure out who somebody was. But I want to end with a quote from Ferenczi and give him the last word. But I want you to recall the backstory that I started my paper with, the movie theater, the cartoonist, the code to be cracked, and the serial killer, and the desire that was born at that moment, the desire that, unbeknownst to me, I would be playing both roles. When Ferenczi wrote these words, he was referring to the inescapable re-traumatization of the patient in therapy. But I think it also aptly applies to the biographer's endeavors. Ferenczi writes, "Apparently, I do not like being continually accused of being a murderer. I have finally come to realize that it is an unavoidable task."
Thank you very much. I'm sure you'll agree that was a fascinating investigation. Thank you very much. Now, our next speaker is Emmanuel Berman, who is going to talk about a virtual therapy group. Thank you.
Sure. Okay. Sure. Okay. This is a moving occasion to celebrate and explore the clinical diary, which found a home at the Freud Museum, and we are all indebted to Judy Dupont, who made it all possible. The timing of this conference is perfect for me, as I just completed editing the Hebrew version of the clinical diary, and I'm grateful to the translator, Orna Wasserman, and to Hayuta Gurevich, who is here with us, who wrote an intriguing introduction. Sandor Ferenczi writes in the clinical diary, when dealing with the dilemmas of confidentiality in mutual analysis of a polygamous analysis, which roughly corresponds to the group analysis of American colleagues, even if it is not carried out in groups. He sees some advantages in the structure, which, I quote, provides a certain reciprocal control over the various analyses and is a way to avoid being excessively influenced by any one patient. He mentions three analyses that run into each other through me. In the group that emerges, he says, there are no secrets among the participants. Ferenczi suggests later on that perhaps it really does not matter if a small group of people is formed whose members know everything about one another. This could even facilitate relations within such a group. It is interesting to note that whereas Ferenczi was astutely aware of many of the risks and complications involved in mutual analysis per se, he did not give enough attention, I think, to the risks and complications of creating such a virtual group without having the benefit of an actual group setting. One could argue that this paradoxical situation of a group without a group may have at times sabotaged Ferenczi's clinical work during this important and fascinating period. On the one hand, the lack of an actual group did not allow a fuller joint in vivo exploration and working through of the stormy emotions, envy, jealousy, competition, Oedipal and incestuous implications, which were unavoidably aroused. On the other hand, this situation deprived some of Ferenczi's analysands of a background of safety, to use Sandler's concept, which is usually enhanced by the individual analysand's privacy and confidentiality, and by the privilege of being, at least most of the time, the only source of information about one's own life. So in some ways, such a virtual group may be less effective in comparison both to a strictly individual analysis and to an analytic therapy group, sacrificing both the privacy and the potentially fruitful work on group process. Let me give one example of the complications involved. The identity of the individuals described is now clearer thanks to Brennan's study, which we just held. And I will skip the nicknames and the codes. You know now what they are. Clara Thompson was socially involved with Natalie Rogers and with Roberta Niederhod. But the relations were tense. Robbie, in particular, disliked Clara. All three were in analysis with Ferenczi at the same time. But as there was no group setting, these tensions were never openly and therapeutically worked through. In an event attributed to 23 June, 32, the three of them sunbathed together. And when Clara moved away, Robbie spoke very harshly of her. Clara heard the insults and became angry. The story was related to Ferenczi by Natalie and by Robbie, but Clara apparently repressed it, though she responded with some form of epileptic fit. When Ferenczi told her what he heard from Natalie and from Robbie, in their analysis, Clara said she knows nothing about it. She was not listening. Ferenczi interpreted this to her as a parapraxis of failing to hear. We can understand Ferenczi's goal, to help Clara overcome her rigid defenses, which he convincingly relates to other aspects of her emotional life. But how effective is such an intervention? My own guess is that it solidifies defenses rather than softening them. Let's consider Clara's subjective experience. Not only was she humiliated by her friend's scorn, but now her own seemingly omniscient analyst rejects outright her version of the story, fully believing them. Transferentially, this can be compared to a child who is scolded by a parent for a misdeed reported by a sibling, and realizing that his or her own account is not accepted. This may create an experience of abandonment. Thompson later reproaches Ferenczi, and he quotes it, for abandoning pupils at the first signs of incomplete adaptation or submission. I wonder if experiences of abandonment contributed to Thompson's subsequent ambivalence towards Ferenczi, discussed by Shapiro in her study and expressed in Thompson's correspondence with De Forest, which Brennan quotes. Now, Ferenczi was in high demand. Some patients waited long before being accepted by him. Still, apparently, he never considered the option of referring to a colleague new patients who are intensely involved with an analysand already working with him. Possibly, that's speculation, he may have enjoyed the experience of omniscience, enhanced by having multiple sources of information about one's patient, without taking into account the emotional price. A striking example is the beginning of the analysis of Natalie Rogers. When Ferenczi accepts, without any reported hesitation, Natalie's request to also take into analysis her female partner, Robbie, he splits the sessions between the two of them. As can be expected, and he reports it, the relationship between Natalie and Robbie is far from simple, creating a natural conflict of loyalties in the countertransference. Ferenczi also treats both Izette De Forest and Alice Lowell, with whom Izette fell in love. I suspect that all such arrangements create severe difficulties in the transference-countertransference sphere. In this assumption, I follow the footsteps of Ferenczi himself, who writes in the diary, "A part of what we call the transference situation is actually not a spontaneous manifestation of feelings in the patient, but is created by the analytically produced situation that is artificially created by the analytic technique." Let me illustrate this difficulty through Ferenczi's relationship with two dyads of patients. Clara Thompson was very fond of Teddy Miller and apparently fell in love with him at one point. And Ferenczi reports, DM demands from me that I should become a good mother to you. I must admit that I love you. You dot. Just as much as I love her. Not an easy task, as Sandor clearly disliked Teddy, attributing to him in the diary criminal tendencies, and in particular he felt dismayed about Teddy's attitude towards women, apparently including Clara, his multiple simultaneous love affairs, and risking his lover's health because he was infected with gonorrhea by a prostitute. Moreover, one wonders if Teddy is the young man who appears in an earlier account about Thompson protesting more or less unconsciously against the analysis, I quote, by shifting her love and interest to a young man. And then Thompson suggested that she will perhaps give up her relationship with this unsuitable and much younger man as a sacrifice. In any case, the triangle created between Clara, Teddy, and Sandor must have been quite tense and conflictual for all three. It was expressed in two separate analyses, in which the needs of the patients might have been irreconcilable, and it may have made it doubly difficult for Ferenczi to work through his complex countertransference reactions to these two patients. These countertransference feelings may have, again my speculation, included jealousy, protectiveness towards Clara, who got involved with a destructive man, a wish to disclose to her Teddy's secrets, gonorrhea, other lovers, while being ethically inhibited from doing so. Probably anger towards Teddy for his conduct, towards Clara, who was known to Ferenczi personally, and so on. Another fateful triangle was created between Ferenczi, Elizabeth Severn, and Hattie Segray, who knew Severn, was her patient in the past, and was very threatened by her. And again I quote from the diary, the second person by whom Hattie feels persecuted possesses psychic qualities. Indeed, the patient had learned from the person herself that she has the power to make people do what she wants by means of her will. Segray's awareness of Severn's dangerous influence probably played a role in a repeated warning to Ferenczi against excessive self-sacrifice, not to let myself be gobbled up by my patient. This probably was the source of Ferenczi's concern about being excessively influenced by any one patient, which I quoted. In the same entry, he describes how the situation became difficult when the two analysants know each other, particularly when the one I let myself analyze by, namely Elizabeth, has neurotic traits and weaknesses of character that make her seem inferior in the eyes of the world. Whereas Elizabeth was the initial co-creator of mutual analysis, Sandor was more fond of Hattie. And he writes, I confess that I would have much preferred to conduct such mutual analysis with my patient as I, who in spite of more horrifying traumas in her childhood, is capable of kindness and selflessness, while in our aunt's case, one always has the feeling that she is constantly pursuing a goal that is finally selfish. This split in Ferenczi's countertransference, with Elizabeth, as he says, representing his actual harsh mother, and Hattie an ideal mother figure led to difficulties in both analyses. Elizabeth was insulted by the comparison and felt deeply misunderstood. Ferenczi writes, I was comparing her to her case to a different, much milder one, as I, and reproached her, as it were, for not being converted to optimism in the same nice and obliging way as the other was. This reproach may be compared to a parent's reproach towards a child. Why aren't you nice and friendly like the neighbor's kid? Such comparisons are, we can guess, never effective as a motivating force, and to the contrary, may be likely to be experienced as a form of betrayal. But the feeling of betrayal was mutual. A few years earlier, Hetty had an outburst in which she accused Shandor, as he describes, that I knew that R.N. was threatening her and persecuting her from afar, and that I was allowing this to happen. At that time, he writes in the diary, the patient allowed herself to be placated by my sincere denial. In the meantime, however, it became clear to me that the patient was in the right, insofar that in the analysis of R.N., I had occasionally identified myself with her and had indeed encouraged her to give her aggression free rein. I also knew that the patient had expressed feelings of hatred against S.I. We don't know whether he ever shared this insight with Hetty, after initially confusing her reality testing by his denial. To summarize my point, polygamous analysis is not an ideal technique. Naturally, similar experiences may occasionally evolve in any analysis, particularly in the analysis of mental health professionals and of analytic candidates who may know each other. When several colleagues who are acquainted see the same analyst, we may witness, as I once discussed, the emergence of the reverse case conference, in which patients discuss their common analyst, often secretly. Such discussions never appear in print, but may have a strong and unacknowledged influence on the seemingly individual treatments. In this respect, an actual analytic group has the advantage of exploring openly many transferential, counter-transferential dramas, such as rivalries, competition for the analyst's affection, common conclusions about the analyst's personality, and so on, and possibly to resolve some of them. As Brennan's research demonstrates, most of Ferenczi's analysants in the early 1930s came from a similar milieu, were foreigners in Budapest, and were quite involved with each other. This situation may have intensified the problematic impact of the polygamous analysis. In one of the most thoughtful and balanced early evaluations of Ferenczi's work during his last few years, Balint, in The Basic Fold, speaks of the grand experiment, which in some ways was repeated by Winnicott, and states, that's Balint's comment, and states that, I quote, in no case in which the atmosphere of a grand experiment was allowed to develop have I seen a real success. He suggests, I quote again, that results are directly determined by the developing therapeutic situation, which is entirely a two-person situation. I generally share Balint's point of view, but I would like to add that Ferenczi's grand experiment was not only a two-person, but also a multiple-person situation, and the complex intersubjective impact of the virtual group of Ferenczi and his patients played a major role in influencing the outcome of this daring and fascinating experiment from which we still have a lot to learn. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Emmanuel. We tried to squeeze too much in, so we have 10 minutes for questions and discussion. Not only on the last presentation, but all three. So there's a roving mic.
It's a question to everyone about the group. How many sisters and brothers did Sandor Fagerzee have?
A lot. 11? 11. Yes. 11. Well, oh, I see. Okay. Yes.
Just a thought about the last presentation. I guess it was a situation of a sibling rivalry. In such situations, sometimes siblings have friendly rivalries. But in your presentation, it sounded like this was more like murderous. But in friendly rivalries, there is kind of like siblings spur each other on for achieving higher milestones or moving along in the progress. Did you have any thought about that? Is that a possibility in that group, in that virtual group, siblings? Could have been a positive influence.
Yes.
A question to Sofer Fortune. Do you think Ferengzi...
Come on. Let's not waste time. Let's just do it. Go on.
If Elizabeth Seven has been also a pupil for Ferengzi, would you accept to say that perhaps Ferengzi has been the pupil of Elizabeth VII.
Sorry, I think I understand. You're just asking is, was he a pupil of hers?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think very much so. In fact, the more I kind of read the diary and read some of the things that she was saying, I really believe he was a pupil of hers. That's why he says this is a worthwhile relationship, even though we hear all the stories about how difficult she was and he didn't like her as much as Essa. I think clearly for me, more and more, I think he learned a great deal from her.
Because in her first book...
In her first book? Sorry.
Yeah. In her first book, we can find some idea which will be that Ferengzi will keep later for about atmosphere, about the family, about surrounding family.
Thank you.
Yes.
I wanted to ask actually the question of why did Ferengzi start writing a diary in 1932? Does anybody want to venture guesses? The timing and,
He says, you know, when he's rejected by Freud, he says in the diary, and he says elsewhere as well, that he had to turn to himself to do self-analysis because Freud refused. Lies the negative countertransference. So he really does say that this was his way of also cleaning himself, but also in going further in his own analysis.
I can't remember, but does he say that in the diary?
Yeah, he does.
Perhaps we can have now another hypothesis. I think when he began to write the diary, when he can no more speak to Ferengzi as a collateral, like a companion, and, And perhaps it's useful for him to be in silence, to be able to write what Freud could not hear at that time. 1932 is Baden, of course.
How are we doing? I'd like to ask maybe Billy to talk to us for 2 or 3 minutes about the ethics of revealing patients.
Well, I'm also curious what everybody else in the room sort of feels about it. When I was doing this work, there would be some colleagues who would be very supportive and who sort of felt that it was very important and were very eager to sort of know who these patients were, especially as the diary is such an important document within the history of psychoanalysis. And we know so many of Freud's patients, who they were and what happened to them. But there were also others who had sort of strong reactions. And I think that if I wasn't an analyst, if I was just a biographer or a historian, then it would be, I would be under a different sort of ethic. Because in some ways the historian is interested in reporting facts, regardless of where they come from. And the biographer is sort of committed to laying everything bare, to sort of tell all. But yet the analyst is under the rubric to keep everything private. And so there I was sort of caught between the two. But also sort of feel that there have been other historians that have gone before me who have sort of forged that way. And when the Freud-Ferenczi correspondence came out, the decision was made that they would print in the Freud-Ferenczi correspondence the names that were mentioned in the letters with a little tiny bio underneath. And so it was sort of in that spirit that I went ahead with it. But I'm curious how others sort of feel about it.
About 15 or 20 years ago, I listened to Joyce McDougall present a case material. And interestingly enough, it wasn't disguised. And she actually had written about the person that she was describing in her book. And so the discussion came up, well, how could you do that? You're not supposed to. It's supposed to be anonymous, not identifiable, patient's privacy. Well, she had discussed this with the patient, and he felt, no, there's no issue here. That's fine with me. If you talk about me in the literature, people should know what went on and who I am and what my background is and so on. So patients may have a different take on it. Now, not all patients, of course, but this was an interesting perspective that I hadn't considered before. And maybe it was the same for Francis Arnold Sands.
When the Freud-Ferenczi correspondence came became published in Germany, there was a, perhaps it has something to do with the German past, also historical past, there was a very important and affective reaction in them, and there was even a written article by Professor Fichtner, who was one of the important person in the Freudian historical research in German, who wrote an article in attacking us why we would disclose all these names in the notes to the Freud-Ferenczi correspondence. And that was really preceded by a long discussion between us, by the way, also with Judith Dupont at the time. And, I mean, private discussions, but we came to the, to absurdities. We thought that if, because of Ferenczi's analysis was very clearly a therapeutic analysis, we should even make the title Freud and X correspondence. I mean, why protect Ferenczi because he became the important analyst after? I mean, what is really? Then we went to the, perhaps for our good consciousness, we went to even consult people, lawyers, and they told us that after 100 years. But why 100 years? That is the same question. So I think that if you go the whole now in Germany, there's a very, even in the historical review, which is called Lucifer Amor, there is a very strict decision that they wouldn't newly publish names who was not yet revealed. But because Eisler revealed some names, why they are good to be revealed, and because we come 20 years later, even if it's later, a generation later, it shouldn't be revealed. So I think that this kind of very rigidly defended position is also full of questions. I just wanted to tell that I think it even merits a discussion forum for it, perhaps even more large than just the fancy people.
Thank you very much. We're going to draw the evening to a close. Before that, I'll remind you that tomorrow we start at 9 o'clock. Please don't stand up yet because we're not quite finished. Tomorrow at 9 o'clock, registration for those who haven't, and 9:30 sharp, the presentations will begin. And now I would like Emmanuel Berman to say a few words.
You know, I would like to remind us that today we are celebrating an additional event, not only the donation of the Freud archive to Ferenczi archive to the Freud Museum, but also the fact that Judy DuPont just very recently won the Sigourney Award, a very central and important award for life work in psychoanalysis. I think this is a very deserved and very moving recognition of many, many years of contributing enormously to our knowledge, to our thinking, to the exploration of Ferenczi's work and Balint's work and Enid Balint's work and Alice Balint's work and this whole huge tradition of the Ferenczi and Balint influence on psychoanalysis, and of Judith's enormous generosity, help to many, many of us, including myself, and I think many people here in the audience and in other places, in any possible effort to explore, to discuss, to understand better, to criticize, to try and figure out the significance of this tradition. So, Judith, we are very, very happy about this award and want to all congratulate you.